Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Some of what lies in our future is exciting. In the years to come, we'll have X-ray vision and space elevators, and we'll be living twice as long. And just maybe, we'll be able to move things like a martini with just our minds. But some of what is yet to come might be something else altogether. Global warming might have cities underwater. Silicon Valley may become part of a newfangled rust belt, if you can believe it. And robots? Well, some will be neat, and some may be programmed to kill. That's Michio Kaku's view of the future, and he outlines it all in his new book, Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. Michio Kaku has been on our show before. He's a quantum physicist, a founder of string field theory, and host of the show Sci-Fi Science on the Science Channel. And it's great to have him back on the show again. Michio Kaku, welcome. Good morning.
Glad to be on the show again.
Well, you talk about so much change here in your book, and I'm wondering if you're more excited about it than you are worried, or is it just the other way around?
I'm excited about it because ever since I was a child watching Flash Gordon on the TV as a kid, I said to myself, wow, that's my future, rocket ships and ray guns and stuff like that. Well, a lot of that has come to be now, and now it's time to think about the year 2100 from a scientific point of view, not a science fiction point of view. This book is based on interviews with 300 of the world's top scientists.
Well, what has you the most excited? What are you hoping to live long enough to see for yourself?
Well, let's take a look at the short term and the long term, okay? Short term, the internet will be so compact, it'll be in our contact lens. So when we blink, we go online. Now just think, when you talk to somebody, your contact lens will identify who they are, print out their biography, and give subtitles if they speak Chinese to you. So you'll be able to speak to anyone, anywhere. And again, prototypes of these things already exist. This is not fiction now.
And so for someone like myself who has trouble remembering names, I'll be in like Flynn, right?
That's right. And if you're a college student taking a final examination, this is for you. You'll blink and all the answers are right there in your contact lens. And if you're a tourist and you go through Rome and all you see are the ruins, you'll blink and the Roman Empire will be recreated exactly as it was in your contact lens. And artists will love it. You simply wave your hand and create sculptures in your contact lens
that how far
you can
away
later
is that?
Make into solid object.
How far
well,
away
about
is this?
10 to 15 years. The first prototypes have already been built at the University of Washington in Seattle. And with computer chips getting tinier and tinier and flatter, nanotechnology definitely makes it possible to put them in your contact lens. The military is even interested in this. For the Science Channel, I took a film crew all the way down to Fort Benning, Georgia, where they have a version of this. It's a tiny little eyepiece that's on your helmet. You just flick it over into your eyes and whoa, the entire battlefield, friendly forces, enemy forces, artillery, airplanes, the whole battlefield is right in your right in front of you in your lens.
Yeah. Well, go
so
back
this
to the
thing is not science fiction.
Go back to the contact lens thing for a moment, Michio. How's that going to work? I blink my eyes and how do I program my contact lenses to go where I want it to go on the internet?
Well, two ways. In the short term, you can have a little device in your hand that allows you to then move the cursor and make decisions. And these already exist, handheld little things you put in one hand with buttons on. A little further down, okay, now we're talking 20, 30 years, you'll do it with your mind directly. Direct mind-computer interface is not something you see in Star Trek. It's something that we can do today on a primitive level. At Brown University, for stroke victims who are vegetables, totally paralyzed stroke victims, we have placed chips in their brains, connected the chips to a laptop, and these people can now surf the web, write email, answer email, play video games, do crossword puzzles, and they are totally paralyzed. They cannot move a muscle at all. And so if you can do that with people that are paralyzed, think about we can do that with ordinary people. And the Honda Corporation already has a helmet that you put on. And just like in the movie with Bruce Willis, Surrogates, and just like the Avatar, you'll be able to control a robot just by putting something on your head, sensors on your head. So four movements can already be executed. The robot's head, shoulder motions can all be done using the power of the mind.
Wow. You know, this idea of using the power of the mind, you also talk about the ability to move a martini across the room using just your mind. Help me understand, how is that possible?
Yeah, here's how it works. Of course, objects like martinis don't move by themselves.
Right.
But we physicists are building what are called super magnets, magnets of enormous power and very, very compact. So, for example, flying cars. Everyone laughs at flying cars. We don't have them. But actually, we do have flying cars, but they're really, really cost inefficient. They just gobble up gasoline like it was nothing. However, with magnetism again, we can make cars that float. And with super magnets, we'll make cars that float almost effortlessly and cheaply. And by placing tiny magnets everywhere, most of the magnets are turned off, you can turn them on mentally and thereby have them move.
Now, how do you turn them on mentally?
Oh, because your mind turns on a battery, that tiny battery that's inside every one of these objects. And just like chips today, your mind can control chips. In the future, your mind will control motors that can move objects around just by thinking about it. And again, we're now good enough that we can even recognize patterns of the mind that correspond to real objects, dogs, cats, houses. And in Japan, there's even a group that wants to photograph dreams. This was once considered totally science fiction. You have to be a fan of the movie Inception to think that you can photograph a dream. But yeah, when you see a pixel of light, it lights up the optic nerve. It lights up part of the brain in a certain way. Pictures are made out of lots of pixels. And so by moving the pixel back and forth, and by recording one-to-one the images in the back of your brain, we now have a dictionary between pixels and MRI scans of the brain. Therefore, if you take a look at a U, a circle, a square, a star, you can pick it out. You can actually photograph it. And this has already been done. This is not science fiction.
God, you're just taking my breath away here. Again, we're visiting with Michio Kaku about his new book, Physics of the Future. You know, you talk about this stuff, and then maybe we should talk just for a moment about the success rate for futurists, because there's been some glaring ups and downs over the centuries when it comes to folks being able to predict the future. Because there was all this talk after World War II, for instance, about the year 2000, when the world would be rid of disease and there would be all manner of interplanetary travel. But a lot of that stuff didn't come true.
That's right. But remember that Arthur C. Clarke and other visionaries that made all those predictions of flying cars and jetpacks, they weren't physicists. No physicist made any of those predictions. We know how hard it is to make a cheap jetpack. We can make a jetpack, but they only last for a few minutes. You need nanotechnology to make them sustain for more than a few minutes. Flying cars exist, but they're gas guzzlers. Only millionaires can afford to buy flying cars. And so as a physicist, we know the limitations of these technologies because we're the ones who created most of the technologies of the 20th century. But we're moving ahead now to the 21st century using known physics, known laws, to create the fabulous number of devices that I mentioned, hundreds of them, predicted in my book, Physics of the Future.
Mm-hmm. So physicists are best, then, is what you're saying.
Well, I hate to be egotistical about it, but
that's what you're saying.
We have a good track record. You know, we invented radio, we invented television, we invented radar, microwaves, lasers, transistors, MRI machines, G-sequencing machines, all of that were invented by physicists.
Okay, fair enough. Well, and again, in fairness to you and your book, you try to improve your odds here by talking to this array of experts that you mentioned just a few minutes ago. How did you approach the book, and how did you decide who you were going to talk to get their best judgments about what might lie ahead here?
Excellent question. You know, when Jules Verne in 1863, at the time of the American Civil War, was writing in Paris, France, he predicted Paris in 1960. That is a 100-year leap into the future. And he predicted, even though everyone around him was a dirt farmer, everyone around him was basically mired in mud whenever it rained, he predicted glass skyscrapers. He predicted gas-fired cars. Hmm. He predicted fax machines and something that resembles the Internet. And how did he do it? Hmm. Whenever people went through Paris, he would buttonhole them, pump them for information to get the latest developments in electricity, the latest developments in transportation. He got the moon rocket to within 10% accuracy.
Wow.
He just missed on the propulsion system. He got the size of the moon rocket right. He got the time it took to go to the moon, 3 days, correct. He got the splashdown correct. He got the landing site, Florida, correct, for the moon rocket, which wasn't to be launched for another 100 years. So I said to myself, the best I can do is interview all these people. I have a ringside seat. I interview scientists every week for the Discovery Channel, Science Channel, BBC Television. I have my own radio show. And I have a front row seat. I'm like a kid in a candy store. I get to meet these people. I get to share the dreams, the passion, the ingenuity of the world's top scientists, Nobel laureates, directors of labs. And unfortunately, none of them have access to the press. None of them. They toil away in their university laboratory or in their basement, quietly believing that they will change history, but no one beats a line to their door to interview them. So I said to myself, hey, I'm a physicist. I published in physics journals. I can get the message out to the Science Channel, Discovery Channel, BBC, and books. And that's why I wrote the book, Physics of the Future.
Huh. Were there some possibilities as you went through your interviews, Michio, that caused you to stop and just say, holy smokes?
Yes. You know, when I was a kid, I thought to myself that, well, maybe I'll live forever. Science is racing ahead. And then I read about understanding of aging, and I realized we were clueless. We didn't know anything about the aging process. It was all hearsay, magic, hocus pocus, nonsense. Now we're making real breakthroughs at the genetic level. You know that we are 98.5% identical to the chimpanzee at the genetic level, and yet we live twice as long. This means that a handful of genes that have been cataloged, some of them contain the secret of doubling our lifespan. This is big. You take the fact that we'll all have $100 genomes in the future, $100, you can have all your genes sequenced. I had most of my genes sequenced by BBC Television. And you sequence the genes of old people by the millions, sequence the genes of young people by the millions, and subtract. That's where aging takes place. Mm-hmm. Where does aging take place in a car? In the engine of the car. Mm-hmm. Well, where is the engine of the cell, the mitochondria? So we even know where aging takes place. Most of aging takes place in the mitochondria, the power plant of the cell where oxidation comes into play. And so we haven't cracked it yet. Don't believe any charlatan who says we have the fountain of youth. But we're getting awfully close.
And so
that is really tantalizing.
And so my children who are in their teens now, I imagine what either them or their children are going to live to be how old, do you think?
Well, I think when they hit the age of 30, they'll decide to stop. And they'll cruise. They'll just cruise at age 30. They'll say, why should I get any older? My cells can clean themselves, repair themselves. Genetic damage can be repaired. And so they might decide to just stay at 30.
Well, how about folks like you and me? Do we have a chance to have our cells cleaned and will I be able to live to 120?
I quote one scientist who said that he hopes that he is not in the last generation to die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, sorry about that. We could be in the last generation that has a natural death because it's still in its infancy, even though we have now tantalizingly 60 genes identified that are linked to the aging process. Now, I mention this because if our grandparents could see us today, you know, our grandparents were dirt farmers, right? Back then, they only lived to be about age of 40 on average. If they could see us with our GPS, our rockets, our iPods, and the internet, they would consider us to be wizards and sorcerers.
Right.
But if we can meet our grandkids and great-grandkids, if we can meet them, how would we view them given the fact that knowledge doubles every 10, 20 years? I'd say that we would consider them to be like the gods of mythology, the Greek gods. Zeus could just move things around with his mind. Venus had a perfect body, ageless body. Apollo had a chariot that took him across the sky like a flying car. And Pegasus was this winged horse, new forms of life that the Greek gods played with.
Yeah.
So I think that's how we would view somebody right now if they were to walk into our living room with the technology of 2100.
Wow.
Not bad, huh?
Not bad. We've talked to Glenn McGee from the Center for Practical Bioethics here in Kansas City about the aging process and the prospects for living to be 150 or 200 years old. If you begin to just think about that for a moment and the implications for what that means for government, for cities, for how we live, for Social Security, the implications just sort of go on and on and on and on here.
Yeah, they do. And some people think we'll just overpopulate the earth and destroy ourselves. But realize that in Japan and Europe, people are prosperous. They live longer. And what do? The first thing they do is not have kids. The birth rate has plunged in Europe and Japan as low as 1.2 children per family. That is way below replacement level. And so what it means is we don't have to worry that we're going to overpopulate the earth once we live longer. We'll have fewer kids and we'll space them out decade by decade. So it's the early inclination to think that we're going to doom ourselves by living longer, I think, is the opposite. We could doom ourselves by not having kids.
Yeah. Again, we're visiting with Michio Kaku about his new book, Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. So I gather that you're just a little more confident that life in 2100 is going to be radically different from what it is today. There's no question about that, right?
No question. Take a look at a simple example, cancer. You realize that Aretha Franklin right now is dying of pancreatic cancer. That killed Patrick Swayze. And in the future, when you use the toilet, your toilet will pick up proteins, from cancer colonies, maybe 100 cancer cells. And your toilet will tell you, uh-oh, we just detected proteins from 100 cancer cells. You will have pancreatic cancer in 20 years. You have plenty of time to take care of it. We now realize that cancer is an extremely slow-moving disease. Once you get it, in 2 years, you're gone, right? That's because that's when you feel it. Steve Jobs has pancreatic cancer. And so it turns out that we now can sequence the genes of pancreatic cancer, and we were shocked to find that it takes about 20 years to kill you. That's plenty of time. Only in the last 2 years can you feel it. So there's plenty of time for DNA chips to detect cancer in your toilet. The word tumor may actually disappear from the English language. Complements of Silicon Valley's DNA chips that are so accurate, they can detect proteins in your blood and your urine. And then we have nanoparticles, molecules that can zap cancer cells. You know, when you think of chemotherapy, it's horrible. I mean, it's really horrible. Your hair falls out, you vomit, your skin turns pale. We'll look at our future kids and grandkids will look at chemotherapy like we look at bloodletting and leeches today.
Wow.
Well, now we have nanoparticles. They already exist, 90% effective in one trial. They're molecules that just fit inside the large holes of a cancer cell, but are too large to fit in the nice smooth holes of a healthy cell. You can machine them just right so they flow right into cancer, but not into a normal cell. This is proven technology, up to 90% effective against certain tumors.
I'm sure a lot of folks listening to this are just absolutely, their heads are reeling by some of the things you're saying here, Michio. It's just astonishing what you're talking about. Let's go to some phone calls. William from over in Lawrence. William, good morning.
Good morning. My question, kind of comment, is I study the laws of God, you know, according to like ancient Egypt. And so I consider myself to be what's called a hermetic philosophist or an initiate. And so what I've learned from that path is that it is a mental universe. And that mind is the most powerful thing, and that nothing exists outside of the mind. So do you think the science in the future is going to prove the science of the past? I believe it will.
Science of the future? Oh, in terms of the mind being the greatest force in the universe?
I think that's where he's coming from,
Yeah, like making stuff happen like boom. But you're talking about computers hooking to the brain. That could be some of the ways that they were able to, you know, to transfer that idea that I'm trying to gather up of research in the past. I believe it had something to do with computers as well as the human mind itself being able to do some pretty amazing feats.
I have some friends, computer scientists and physicists, in fact, who believe that if you go not just 100 years, but a million years now into the future, we'll be way into outer space. Computers will be incredibly powerful. And at that point, the mind becomes the dominant force within that structure. And so that once you start to go not just 100 years on the Earth, but into outer space on a scale of millions of years, then you're talking about potentially the mind being able to control asteroids and meteors and comets. However, this is speculation. I mean, the book Physics of the Future is based on real therapies, prototypes that actually exist in the laboratory, everything I saw with my own eyes.
Mm-hmm.
However, there's nothing in the laws of physics to prevent us from imagining millions of years in the future when perhaps we can even move entire planets with the mind. But that is way beyond my book.
Hmm. William, thank you for the phone call. Let's go to Mike from Kansas City, Missouri. Mike, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Go ahead, Mike.
Well, since you're talking in mathematical terms, I like practical usage of biological information, and you're talking about population expansion and the population of overwhelming the Earth. And if you take the planet as a whole and take the population, if you gave everybody a 3-foot by 3-foot area, you could almost fit the population of the world within the state of Florida. So there's plenty of room for the expansion, growth of food. It's just the distribution of that population more than the actual birth rate that ends up being an issue. I would like to see that we'd have the potential in the future of either genetically or population-wise expanding some of those areas that are overpopulated and develop those into areas where you can develop food so that we're not dealing with having to ship food from our country to other countries, but get those populations where they could be closer to food they can grow locally. And therefore, it's not a matter that can we genetically make enough food in the United States to ship it to Africa, but can we actually make food that can grow within the actual bounds of Africa's, because they got a tumultuous kind of climate. You know,
right.
It's really dry one year and then they're flooded the next year. But I see the expansion of our ability technologically to be able to do that.
What about it, Michio?
Well, you raise actually several interesting points. What is the carrying capacity of the Earth? You're right that if you put everybody in Florida, we'll all have a little cubicle and we're not going to have much room, but you could do it. And most of the Earth is desert, oceans, unpopulated, rocky areas. If you take an airplane, it's obvious that most of America is empty,
mm-hmm.
not full at all. But to start to move large numbers of people or move large agricultural growing areas, that has practical problems. Some people may not want to move. They may live on the coast and feel perfectly happy being there. They don't want to be relocated. Agricultural areas, it's hard to make the desert bloom when there's no water. And so, unfortunately, even though the ideas that you mentioned are correct, there's a practical limitation to how much you can move agricultural areas and how much you can move populations. I think what most scientists are focusing on now is to make existing agricultural areas bloom, like, for example, creating super rice.
Hmm.
If we can create super rice genetically, it would grow in arid environments. And it would be very cheap, and it could literally revolutionize the way we feed most of the planet Earth. And this and many other things are mentioned in my book, Physics of the Impossible. I think Physics of the Future.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the future with Michio Kaku. We'll talk about some of the downsides of what this technology might represent. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we are back. This is the second half of Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. This hour we're visiting with Michio Kaku about his new book, Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny in Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. He's talking about some absolutely astonishing possibilities for the future, including X-ray vision and space elevators and internet connections on your contact lenses. Just amazing stuff. You know, Michio, when we're talking about the dangerous side of technology, I'm wondering who's watching out for potential problems that might be arising here if we're able to extend our lifespan, for instance, as we were talking about in our first half, and defeat diseases, then we might face overpopulation and the possibility of not enough resources to support everyone. Do scientists look at the potential problems that can arise out there and how to face them? Because if they're not looking at this stuff, then who is?
Well, you raise some very valid points. First of all, if you want to make contact with me, you can go to my website, mkaku.org, mm-hmm. mkaku.org. And unfortunately, there's no world body that has wise men and women in a room contemplating these things.
Right.
We just have think tanks. We have universities, pockets of intellectual brilliance around the world looking at these questions. And you're right. Science is a sword. One side of the sword can cut against ignorance, poverty, disease. The other side of the sword can cut against people. And we saw that during World War II, where science unleashed the atomic bomb and poison gas and machine guns and carpet bombing. So it depends on who wields the sword. And that's why education is so important. Let me tell you my philosophy of this.
Mm-hmm.
No two democracies have ever warred in the history of the world. Think of all the wars you've studied ever since you were in grade school. Hundreds of wars, right? They've always been between dictators and monarchies and dictatorships and democracies. But no two democracies have ever warred. Therefore, the Internet is a democratizing influence, which I think will dampen the fires of war. Because as people are connected democratically, as they become prosperous, they don't want to send their sons off to war to die in some nameless cause. And so I think there's some room for optimism there. But you're right. Science does have a downside.
There was this the first World Conference on the Future of Science that was held in Venice back in 2005. It was convened because of concerns that unrelenting scientific progress was not being adequately discussed, which, of course, brings up this interesting point. Should non-scientific members of society be brought into the discussion of if, how, and when new scientific discoveries and advances should be employed?
Well, my attitude is science education is going to be key, because the American people very soon are going to be debating the future of nuclear energy. They're going to be debating the future of the space program. They're going to be debating the future of, well, everything, because budgets are being cut right now. And that's where science education comes in. But unfortunately, scientists almost rarely, almost never make contact with the average person. It's usually the science fiction writer, the sociologist, the psychologist who speaks for science, but they're not scientists, and they get everything upside down, backwards, and inside out.
Yeah.
And so that's one reason why I wrote this book and why other scientists are beginning to write books, because we have to realize that we have to engage the taxpayer. Because they're the ones footing the bill, and they're the ones who are going to be making these horrendously important decisions in the next decade as we cut the budget, as we begin to go into the future of biotechnology and robotics and artificial intelligence. We have to make sure that the public is educated to make wise decisions about these things.
Yeah. Michio, we have an email here from Ross who writes, what are your thoughts about unlocking the unused potential in our minds?
Well, there's this old saw that we only use 10% of the brain,
right,
90% of the brain is not used. That's actually not true. Somebody actually tried to nail down exactly where that myth came from. And it came from the 1930s during the pulp era when we had The Shadow and we had all these Superman stuff coming out. That's when the overheated imagination of the science fiction writers came in. We use all our brain. Not very efficiently, but of course the human potential is great. But if you look at MRI scans, you see the entire brain lighting up like a Christmas tree, even when you're daydreaming. And so, however, I think the point the person is raising is we can be incredibly more efficient if we focus ourselves and start to realize that we underutilize our full potential. And again, I get a lot of emails from people saying, gee, I wish I had become a scientist when I was young. I wish I had used my full potential when I was young.
Right.
It's never too late to be fascinated by science. I work in professionally string theory, and I get to work on things like time travel and dimensional gateways and wormholes. This is what I do for a living. That's my day job. That's what I get paid to do. And it's very fulfilling knowing this, knowing that I, quote, lived my full potential, unquote. So I think for all you out there who can listen to this program, live your dreams and live to your full potential.
Let's go to Brad from Prairie Village. Brad, you're on up today. Good morning.
Yeah, I was wondering what can be done to fight scientific illiteracy. I mean, you try to explain to somebody about a boiling water nuclear reactor with blended plutonium fuel, and they don't understand how cement works, how the stop valve works in their toilet, or how a car starting system works.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a long haul. It's sad. Scientifically speaking, when you have international students take science exams, The United States comes out near dead last in science and math.
Yeah.
It's really a shame, all this underutilized potential. And part of it is, well, you know, back in the 1950s, we had, quote, the Sputnik moment. And that's what Obama keeps talking about, the Sputnik moment. That's when it was practically your patriotic duty to become a rocket scientist back then. It was your duty to become a physicist or a chemist. We've lost that edge. And that doesn't bode well for the economic future because China understands the Sputnik moment. They're sending their top physicists to the United States, where I see them in our physics department. Half the physics department is from China. Huh. And so you realize that other countries are not lagging behind. They know that physics and science is their meal ticket. That's their ticket to the future. The people who don't understand it are we in the United States who've already used that to become prosperous. And at Harvard and Princeton, the top students go into investment banking. They don't go into physics and mathematics and chemistry anymore. And so that doesn't bode well.
Hmm. You know, when you go, you talk about computers, Michio, you were talking about the future there and the potential capabilities. What about laptop computers? Because you suggest they may soon be a relic, just like Silicon Valley may become part of a new Rust Belt, which is just amazing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I take a look at what happened to electricity. It used to be that when you had a little motor in a factory, your whole factory had to be based around that motor. Now, electricity is, well, it's everywhere. It's in the ground. It's in the ceiling. It's in the walls. In fact, it's metered. You don't even mm-hmm. see it anymore. You just meter it now. Mm-hmm. So electricity is everywhere and nowhere. And that's the future of the computer and the laptop. The future of the computer is to disappear, just like the electric motor disappeared. The electric motor has gone, electricity is everywhere, and in the future, computing power will be under your feet, in the walls, in the ceiling, and we will meter it, and that's called cloud computing. So computing power will be everywhere and nowhere. You simply talk to things, and they activate. Cars will drive themselves, for example. Google is investing millions of dollars to have the first driverless car on the market within about 8 years' time.
Wow.
And so cars will drive themselves, appliances. You just talk to them, and they go about their business.
Will we reach a point where the microchip can shrink any smaller, or is it already as small as it's going to get?
Oh, no, it's going to get even smaller than that. We went to the University of Pittsburgh, where some scientists dream about shape-shifting. Now, people say, no, come on, give me a break.
What do you mean by that?
Terminator 2. The ability to take an object and turn it into any other object by shifting its shape. Just like Terminator 2, just like the X-Men. There's a shape-shifter in the X-Men movies. Well, at the University of Pittsburgh, what they do is they take microchips and etch it so small, it's like smaller than the head of a pin. And it has the full computing power of a PC at the head of the pin. And it controls the electrical charges on the surface. And so these bind with other pinpoints in any programmable way. Now think about it. Any object is composed of atoms. How you arrange the atoms can create anything, anything mm-hmm. from an ocean liner to a hot dog stand to a rocket ship. You simply rearrange the atoms. Well, they want to rearrange the chips. This is called programmable matter, and I had a demonstration of this. I said to myself, whoa, you're talking Terminator 2 now. You're talking the ability to create one object, mold it any way you want into another object right before your eyes. Now, artists will love this because they'll be able to take any object, mold it, and it'll change shape, and you can program its shape any way you want. People who design cars can simply revamp the shape every time a new model comes out. You don't like your house? No problem. You simply program the house to change shape. You want a city in the desert? You push a button and a whole city rises in the desert. Of course, that may take a century to get that off the ground.
Holy moly.
It's all well within the laws of physics, and I had a demonstration of this at the University of Pittsburgh.
You're just taking my breath away. I'm just wondering about the human beings' ability to adapt to all of this change, to all of this potential. I mean, you're really painting a dramatically different set of potentials here than we're even close to experiencing right now, Michio.
Yeah, but you know, the kids will love it. The kids, you know, the old timers, we're too old.
Yeah,
you know, I can't learn the stuff. You know,
it's all cool to a 20-year-old. Right. Yeah. Yeah, no,
yeah,
I get the kids.
That.
Let's go back to some
kids.
Phone.
I tell you, man, they'll love this stuff.
Let's go to Nancy from Lawrence, who wants to talk about the perils of this new technology. Nancy, good morning.
thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering about the Orwellian potentials of some of this technology of total control of matter, and how would that be a problem in light of the funding sources such as military? Like, I've read about the militarization of neuroscience, what kind of oversight mechanisms might be in place to prevent abuse? Because if you look at human nature and human behavior historically, you see that unrestrained power is always abused. Such people like Philip Zimbardo and the Stanford Prison Experiment. And how would you contain that? What kind of oversight?
Michio?
Well, you raise a very valid question. I read the book 1984 before getting right into this book. And that, of course, introduced the concept of Big Brother.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Big Brother might have actually happened back in the 1980s because the Internet was conceived of as a military weapon. The military did not spend billions of dollars just so that you can get on Facebook. The military did not spend billions to give you GPS just so that your kids don't get lost. These are military weapons. However, in 1989, a historic event took place unnoticed by most journalists and most people. The National Science Foundation was entrusted with the Internet, and in 1989, the National Science Foundation gave it away for free. The Soviet bloc broke up. There was no purpose to have an Internet anymore, and so they gave it away, and the rest is history. Now we realize that Big Brother is not the problem. The problem is Little Brother. Nigerian scam artists, people who want to steal your identity, pesky busybodies, tabloid journalists who want to steal the gossip on movie stars. That's the main pesky development of the Internet. And the Internet, as I mentioned, is a democratizing force. It's overthrowing entire governments right now, as we see when the power of the people is unleashed. Now, you raise a good point. The military will try to do all sorts of sometimes rather bizarre things in order to get an edge over, let's say, Russia. If you take a look at some of the most outrageous abuses during the Cold War, some of them are actually rather laughable in the sense that the military hired psychics to locate Soviet submarines in the ocean. They hired psychics in order to read the minds of Soviet military leaders, things that we laugh at today. And so you have to realize that the military also is behind the times. They, too, are behind what is happening in the laboratories. They get swayed by all sorts of charlatans and hocus-pocus palmists and people like that. The military sometimes asks me for advice, and I'm constantly amazed at how illiterate some of these military people are about what's happening in the laboratories. So, yeah, there's a lot of mischief going on. But, again, a lot of that was driven by the Cold War. And so the Cold War did cover up a lot of really horrendous things, experimentations on people's bodies without their permission. Hopefully, there's more oversight on these things so we don't have the repeats of the excesses of the Cold War.
Yeah. Thank you for the phone call, Nancy. Chad writes us this question, Michio. All the technology, fighting cancer, and long life talk is wonderful, but are poor people included in the future of the world? And how so, if that's the case?
Okay, let's be blunt about this. There are winners and losers in any big revolution. The big winners are those that realize that the world economy is making a transition from commodity capital to intellectual capital. That's what it's all about. Commodity capital is, of course, steel and copper and food. But food prices have been dropping for 150 years. The breakfast you had today, the King of England could not have had 100 years ago. Think of what you eat today. Delicacies from around the world that are dirt cheap that the King of England could not have had 100 years ago. That's the falling price of commodities. Now, Tony Blair liked to say that England derives more revenue from rock music than it does the coal mining industry. And it's true. You think of a British worker. You think of a coal miner. But that's not where the money is. The money is in rock and roll. So realize that intellectual capital is not just software. Intellectual capital is books, artwork, the internet, imagination, writing a song, writing a script, doing a scientific experiment.
Right.
These are things that robots cannot do, things that involve imagination, creativity, leadership. These are things that we do that robots cannot, and they're going to be the value system more and more of the future. The Chinese understand that. They're leveraging commodity capital. They're leveraging cheap labor in order to send their physicists to the United States, where I see them, where they set up entire industries when they go back to China. And so they understand this. They're not stupid. They know that their economy has to make a transition from commodity capital to intellectual capital. But the question is, now think about it. How many nations are making this transition? Think of sub-Saharan Africa. You know, take out a map. How many countries there are making the transition from agriculture to intellectual capital? Mm-hmm. And then you begin to realize, oh, my God. Then you begin to realize there are going to be winners and losers in the future. The winners will be those nations that understand this. You have to have a two-pronged strategy. Yeah, you have to have commodities, but also you have to have a foot in high tech. You have to have a foot in entertainment, Hollywood. You have to have a foot in things that people want to buy in the future. And that's a warning. Hmm. The warning is you can ignore this technology as much as you want. You can laugh and snicker as much as you want about technology. But unless you watch out, it's going to run you over. That's why this book will arm you with the information you need to understand the future.
And that book is Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. Michio Kaku is the author of that book. Again, our number 816-235-2888. Michio, you mentioned robots, which have all this potential to change our lives for the better, but they also have potential to make our lives miserable. You talk about robots being programmed for mayhem and murder. What about that?
Well, first of all, in Japan, which makes 30% of all industrial robots, the Shinto religion says that everything has a spirit in them, including robots. So children in Japan love robots.
Right.
Robots are everywhere in Japan. Kids love them. They get them from Christmas. They play with them. They go to bed with them. But in the West, robots are Arnold Schwarzenegger in the Terminator movies. They kill. They're on the rampage. They're out to kill you.
Right.
And so you see a difference in opinion there. But look, we don't have to be afraid of robots yet because they have the intelligence of a cockroach. Our most advanced robots can just barely walk across the room. They look intelligent. That's because they're remote controlled by a human. Mm-hmm. A robot all by itself has the intelligence of a bug. In fact, a stupid bug. Now, of course, eventually they'll be as smart as a rabbit. Mm-hmm. Eventually they'll be as smart as a cat, then a dog. And eventually by 2100, maybe they'll be as smart as a monkey. At that point, I do believe we should put a chip in their brain to shut them off if they have murderous thoughts. Let's be blunt about this. Robots can kill. And so, by the end of the century, we may have to put what I call an Asimov chip in their brain to regulate them if they start to have murderous thoughts. Simultaneously, we should begin to enhance ourselves as well so that we're not left behind in the evolutionary dust heap. We, too, can begin to have superpowers. You don't want to look like the Borg with things dangling out of your brain.
Mm-hmm.
You want to look cool. You want to look sexy. You want to have a super body, and that is well within the laws of physics.
Huh. Back to some phone calls here. Cynthia from Prairie Village. Thanks for holding on, Cynthia.
Yes, I've noticed that whenever Apple Computer comes out with something brand new, there's a huge rush to go buy the product. And I'm curious, do you find with technology that there is, over the years, a decrease in resistance to new technology, where to a point it will be non-existent?
Well, I think the older we get, the more resistant we are to technology. When I want to find out what's happening with the latest technology, I ask my kids.
Mm-hmm.
And they're always one step ahead of me. And one day they'll probably ask their kids because they're going to be left behind in the dust too.
Yeah.
And so I think something's happening here in the sense that we get set in our ways and we begin to realize that we're comfortable with where we are. But young people love Facebook because it allows them to talk to people from across the world. So we realize that national boundaries of the future may also start to melt. Dictatorships are going to have a harder and harder time controlling their people, and that's the power of information. In the future,
But the speed of Facebook, that's something I want to point out. That was incredibly fast. I mean, 20 years ago, Facebook, although a fantastic idea, would not have caught on as quickly as it did. I mean, is that an accurate assessment?
Why would 20 years ago it not take off so quickly if they had the capability 20 years ago?
That's the question, because I'm thinking that people are embracing newness, even though it might be someone younger than you and I. The embracing of new ideas, it appears to be faster.
Yeah, only because computer powers are faster. Back then, computers were very slow and kind of clunky. 20 years ago, you were happy to have a few kilobytes in your memory. Now you have a few gigabytes in your memory.
Right.
So because computers were not that powerful back then, but if a Facebook were available 20 years ago with the power of Facebook today, with gigabyte memories, I'm sure 20 years ago they would have embraced it with the same rapidity. But it's just that the technology wasn't available 20 years ago.
Right. Cynthia, thank you for the call. Let's go to Kevin from Lee Summit. Kevin, good morning.
Hi there. Good morning. I'll make this really fast. It seems to me like the high likelihood solar energy, particularly with photovoltaic cells, is going to be extremely not just likely, but on our doorstep. And so that we would put these all over our buildings and our cars and that kind of thing and have much less need for power companies, quite frankly.
Hmm. Well, yes and no. Now, solar power is still about twice as expensive as fossil fuels. Pound for pound, gasoline has an enormous amount of energy, more than solar. However, with the gradual rising and uncertainty in fossil fuel prices, the dramatic falling of solar costs, the two curves should cross in about 10 years' time, at which point we may enter the solar hydrogen era, perhaps by 2020. It'll actually be cheaper to make the Sahara Desert a solar factory than to import gasoline from the Middle East. And then by 2030, fusion power should come in as a commercial force. The French and the European Union are dumping billions of dollars to perfect the ITER fusion reactor in southern France. Fusion is different from fission, by the way. Fission is what's racking Japan right now, with nuclear waste being dumped into the atmosphere over Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Fusion has almost no nuclear waste at all, except maybe helium, and helium is actually commercially valuable. Mother Nature does not even use fission power. Mother Nature does not use uranium to generate energy. Mother Nature uses hydrogen to generate the energy of the stars. So by 2030, we should be entering the solar fusion era. So the danger period with regards to global warming is not forever. I think by mid-century, the world would be producing much less carbon dioxide but consuming more energy because we'll be in the solar hydrogen era.
And
just but the danger period is now.
Just 30 seconds left, Michio. When you talk about zoos filled with animals that are now extinct, you're talking about what, the use of stem cells there, or how is that going to work?
I interviewed a biotech genius, an entrepreneur, who took an animal's carcass that was dead for 25 years, took a cell from it, cloned it, and brought it back to life.
Wow.
This is now going
to
be the norm. We're going to have zoos of extinct animals in the future.
Like dinosaurs.
Mammoths,
well,
not dinosaurs, but Neanderthals. We've sequenced the entire genome of a Neanderthal, and there are some people who say maybe we should try to bring back the Neanderthal. These are all things that we will discuss in the coming decades.
Well, Michio, I think you succeeded in rocking all of our worlds this morning, and I sure appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. I sure enjoyed it. We spoke with physicist Michio Kaku in March. His latest book is Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny in Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. You'll find more information about our guests, previous broadcasts, and podcasts all at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow, we revisit our conversation with Leewood author Candace Mollard about her bestseller, Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. We had help today from KCUR's Danny Alexander and Maria Carter. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.